Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Orlando Science Center, presenting Life, an all-new exhibit on nature and conservation. Animals are the real storytellers of life's three distinct environments: rainforest, ocean, and swamp, with hands-on experiential learning that vividly demonstrates humanity's interconnectedness with the natural world. More at osc.org.
2 years of JWST team and a Falcon 9 malfunction. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The James Webb Space Telescope is celebrating 2 years of science operations, and to commemorate the occasion, the team released an image of two galaxies, commonly known as the Penguin and Egg.
What you see are two galaxies that are close enough together to interact.
Astronomer Christine Chen tells us more about the image and the science of JWST. Then, a recent SpaceX Starlink satellite mission had a malfunction. Falcon 9 rocket had issues with the upper stage, and 20 satellites were released into the incorrect orbit.
They actually burned up in reentry of Earth's atmosphere.
Space industry analyst Laura Forsick joins us to talk about the implications of the malfunction for SpaceX and future astronaut missions. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? 10 times farther away than the Andromeda Galaxy are two galaxies with very unique shapes, the Penguin and the Egg. The pair once passed by one another millions of years ago and are now passing by once again, like a cosmic loop around each other. And now they're interacting and creating new stars, captured in new images released by the James Webb Space Telescope science team. Here to talk about those images and how JWST is revolutionizing the way we observe and study our universe is Christine Chen, an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this is an extremely exciting day, 2 years of science operations of the James Webb Space Telescope, and you've released an image with two galaxies for this anniversary. Tell us a bit about the image. I'm looking at it now. It's absolutely spectacular, but describe what I'm looking at.
Absolutely. It is super beautiful. What you see are two galaxies that are close enough together to interact. So we think that they first passed by each other about 25 to 75 million years ago, and we think that they'll continue their cosmic dance with each other for millions more years. The galaxy on the right is called the Penguin, and it used to be a spiral galaxy, just like our Milky Way, but it passed really close to the galaxy on the left, which is called the Egg, and it became wildly distorted. If you look really closely at the Penguin, you can see that the eye used to be the center of the spiral galaxy, and that the beak and the back of the Penguin used to be its spiral arms. So we kind of learn from this that the beautiful structure of spiral galaxies is actually pretty delicate, and it can be easily torn apart when they encounter other galaxies. The galaxy on the left, the Egg, is called an elliptical galaxy. And elliptical galaxies are dense, kind of like a cannonball. And so they're more difficult to change shape.
I am looking at it, and it does look like a penguin. So that's a phenomenal description of it. You said that this Penguin galaxy is a spiral galaxy much like our own, and it's being kind of distorted because it came too close to this other galaxy. Do we need to be concerned about our galaxy doing this in the future? This looks pretty gnarly. I don't think I would want this to happen to us.
It is pretty gnarly. Absolutely. Well, luckily, we're safe. In our local neighborhood of galaxies, we have a nearby neighbor called the Andromeda Galaxy, and we do expect that one day it'll come crashing into the Milky Way. But thankfully for us, it's going to happen billions of years from now, so not when any of us are still around.
We'll be gone. All right, perfect. there are two images that you released, right? I'm looking at one image right now, and the Penguin Galaxy is kind of this like neon orange color. And then the other one, it's got this like purple and green and white. What is the difference between these two images that I'm looking at?
Sure. One of the images was taken with the Hubble Space Telescope in visual light that our eyes can see. And the other one was taken by the James Webb Space Telescope in infrared light. So those are wavelengths that are longer than what our eye can see and that we can, we typically feel as heat, right? So when you look at the Hubble Space Telescope image and you look around the eye of the Penguin, there's actually this kind of stripe that goes across the eye and kind of down the back a little bit. And that's actually a dust lane in that galaxy. So in the spiral arms, you get dust. And, you know, they can obscure the light from stars that are in the galaxy. So one of the superpowers of being in the infrared is that you can see through dust. And so when you look through the JWST, you don't actually even see that dust lane in the image.
Mm-hmm. And you've got on the JWST website, there's this really cool tool where you can slide between the Hubble image and the JWST image. And I'm seeing that vein kind of disappear, and I'm peering through the clouds there. As you mentioned, that is one of the advantages of using infrared observations. What are you able to see more now that dust cloud is away? What have we learned more about this Penguin galaxy because of what JWST has on board?
So when galaxies like spiral galaxies interact, it actually triggers star formation in the galaxy. And so that star formation can be enshrouded in dust and gas and be hard to see. And so the infrared lets us peer through it to see the baby stars that are forming in the hearts of those star-forming regions.
So I'm looking at baby stars. So not only is this an adorable-looking penguin, I'm looking at baby stars in here as well.
Exactly. Yep. You got it.
And does that give us a better sense of kind of what's going on in this particular galaxy? Now, if you're seeing all these stars being formed, are you able to drill down and see like even what types of stars are being born? And could there possibly be some exoplanets, you know, living in those habitats?
Absolutely. So we can drill down and we can see the individual stars. And some astronomers are interested topically in like how star formation works. Like, for example, you know, does star formation happen one place and does it trigger star formation other places? Like, how important are these mergers in like triggering star formation in galaxies? So that's a whole science topic, right? But you brought up a really exciting area that, astronomers are really interested in using JWST for, and that is the study of exoplanets. So for the observatory, about, I think, almost 30% of the proposals that the observatory receives every year are to study exoplanets and exoplanet formation. It's really hard to look at the planets around stars in galaxies that are that far away. So instead, these exoplanet and exoplanet formation studies tend to focus on stars that are much more nearby. So maybe within hundreds of light years instead of being, you know, millions of light years or more away.
We're speaking with Christine Chen. She is an associate astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. Christine, I'm also looking at the slider, which is going to absolutely destroy productivity for me today because I'm so mesmerized by this. But I'm sliding from Hubble and I'm sliding to JWST, and on the Hubble image, what looks like these little tiny dots or smears turn into very pronounced looking galaxies. Tell me a bit about that.
So you have identified, yes, the second superpower of JWST, which is to see distant galaxies. So this is because when we're thinking about our universe, we know that the universe formed in a big bang and everything flew apart, and the universe is continuing to get bigger and bigger all the time. It's expanding. And so that means that galaxies are flying away from us, and the farther they are away from us, the more rapidly they're flying away from us, right? If we think about like cars that go by us and the sound that they make, they kind of do this, right? So they become a higher pitch when they come towards us and then a lower pitch as they move away. So the sound waves kind of get compressed and then stretched out. So the same thing happens from the light from these galaxies. As they're flying away, the light from them gets stretched out from visual wavelengths that our eyes can see to the infrared wavelengths that JWST can see. And so this is why one of JWST's superpowers is to see the first galaxies, because the light from all of those first galaxies is redshifted into the infrared, where JWST has ability to see detail and sensitivity.
And looking at this, Christine, like, I am completely overwhelmed at everything that I'm looking at. And you said within this Penguin galaxy, in this image that you released, there's baby stars being born. And around those stars, we now know that there could be planets. There is just so much out there. How do you figure out what to point JWST at when literally are this image I'm looking at, there's got to be hundreds of galaxies in here. How do you focus your observations with such a powerful telescope when there's so much to look at?
Oh, that is a great question. So JWST is still relatively early in its mission. And so at the beginning of the mission, we really relied on other observatories to tell us what might be interesting. And then we would go and follow up like the results from other observatories with JWST, and we would discover more things. And that would open like even more questions. And so when we get these new questions, we go back to other observatories, to try to answer them. So when I say other observatories, what I mean is that JWST is an infrared telescope. But to understand the universe, we actually have to look at the universe across the entire electromagnetic spectrum. So not just the infrared, but visual light that our eyes can see, X-rays, long wavelengths like radio as well. And so you can kind of think of all of these observatories as a basketball team, and they pass the ball back and forth so that they can score new discoveries.
Mm-hmm. What new discoveries are on the horizon? What might this team of telescopes be able to uncover over the next few years?
Absolutely. So my particular interest is understanding how planetary systems form and evolve. So with JWST, one of its great strengths is to look at water and organic molecules in the infrared. So this has been a key question for a long time, is how do we follow the trail of water to understand how water got into, for example, the Earth in our solar system? And we think water is important because it's a critical component to life anywhere in the galaxy. So I'm really excited to continue using JWST and to understand how water might end up on terrestrial planets. So this is important because we think that Earth probably formed without water and that it showed up later. So with JWST, we can study water in other planetary systems to see how similar or different they are to our own solar system.
In journalism, they say follow the money. In astronomy, they say follow the water. So is that what you're looking for? Well, finally, Christine, I know your time is limited. You all are celebrating 2 years of JWST science operations. This is an incredible image that you've released on the anniversary of it, but there are hundreds of more observations. Is there one particular one that you have been really excited about that JWST has captured over its 2 years in operation?
Yeah, there are so many great results. It's really hard to pick one. In my area of study, understanding the formation and evolution of planetary systems, a couple of images that I really love. One appeared in the New York Times of the young star Fomalhaut, and it discovered an asteroid belt around that star for the very first time that wasn't seen with any other imagery. There's also another image of a planetary system called Beta Pictoris, where there's a new filament of dust that's been detected, and we think that's been caused by comets crashing into one another and creating dust that's been blown out of the planetary system by the star. So absolutely looking forward to more wonderful discoveries through the years.
Mm-hmm. My mind is blown thinking that you can see evidence of water molecules and asteroid belts outside of our own solar system. It's absolutely incredible the work that JWST and astronomers like yourself are doing. Christine Chen is Associate Astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. Christine, thank you so much for joining us, and happy 2 years to JWST.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Still to come, SpaceX's Falcon 9 mission malfunction and satellites burning up in Earth's atmosphere. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. On July 11th, SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket launched beautifully from Vandenberg Air Force Base, but once in orbit, there was a malfunction. An issue with the rocket's second stage resulted in 20 Starlink satellites being released in a very low orbit. The satellites never made it to their intended space, and the Falcon 9 rocket was grounded as SpaceX investigates the issue. Might this grounding affect upcoming human missions, like Polaris Dawn, a private crew mission bankrolled by billionaire Jared Isaacman, or the upcoming commercial crew missions to launch four astronauts for NASA to the International Space Station? Here to help answer those questions is Laura Forsick, a space industry analyst and founder of the consulting firm Astrolytical. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Yeah, so let's jump straight into it. Falcon 9 recently had problems in the upper stage of its rocket. I know that the investigation is ongoing right now with SpaceX, but what do we know happened?
Successfully, SpaceX completed all of its milestones until it got to a burn for reigniting the second stage engine. And there was ice buildup due to a liquid oxygen leak. And that ice buildup caused the engine, when it was relighting, to explode. That didn't stop the satellites from being deployed, but it did mean that they got deployed in the wrong orbit, a much, much lower orbit. And it also meant that it was the first Falcon 9 failure, partial failure, in 9 years.
We'll talk more broadly about what this means for SpaceX, but let's focus on the Starlink satellites. You said they did get deployed, but just not in the right place. Where were they supposed to be, and where are they now?
So Starlink satellites hang out in low Earth orbit, which is a large range, but they got put in a very low Earth orbit, about 135 kilometers up. And space roughly begins around 100 kilometers, 50 miles if you're American. And that is just too low for Starlink satellites. They're not designed to stay that low. There's atmospheric drag even at 135 kilometers. So they were dropping, every time they circled the Earth, they were dropping about 5 kilometers, which meant that they actually burned up in reentry of Earth's atmosphere within hours, maybe a couple of days of when they were launched, which is not supposed to happen. They're supposed to stay up there a while longer.
Mm-hmm. Is there any concern that they could be a threat to us down here on Earth? You mentioned they burn up in the atmosphere. Does that mean we don't have to worry about one of them plunking on our heads?
That's correct. These are not large enough to survive reentry. There are concerns that our models for what gets burnt up and what survives through the Earth's atmosphere is a little bit off. And so we have been seeing increasing reports that Starlink satellites, actually not Starlink, but satellites that we expect to burn up totally are actually surviving a little bit. But that shouldn't be the case with these Starlink satellites. They should have completely burned up and not be a problem.
Are they essentially pieces of space junk or space trash at this point? And I know they won't pose a risk to you and me down here on Earth, but low Earth orbit's pretty crowded. If they're not in the right spot, could they pose a threat to other assets that are in space?
In general, yes. With these particular ones, no, because they've already burned up. There's already, they were watching them. We're actually trying to boost them back up, SpaceX was. They reestablished connection with half of them. So 10 of the 20, they reestablished connection. They were trying to boost them. They failed to boost them. External trackers found two of them, and that was days ago, and they've all burned up by now. So in general, yes, we do need to worry about space junk, especially in low Earth orbit, which is getting very crowded. But these particular satellites are already gone.
They're gone. How does that impact SpaceX and SpaceX's Starlink constellation? I mean, will this have a long or lasting impact to Starlink access?
Not due to the Starlink constellation itself. This was 20 satellites. Starlink is composed of over 6,000 satellites at this point. So it's a setback, but it's a very, very minor one. What's a much, much bigger setback is the fact that now the Falcon 9 rockets are grounded. That means that SpaceX, in collaboration with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, is doing an investigation to determine what went wrong. And while that investigation is going on, there are no Falcon 9s launching, which is a huge problem for not just SpaceX, but all of SpaceX's customers, including NASA.
Let's talk about that. Really, the only U.S. vehicle that's approved by NASA to take crew members to the ISS right now is SpaceX's Crew Dragon. As you mentioned, it gets a ride on a Falcon 9 rocket. The second stage of this Falcon 9 rocket is under investigation, and the system itself is grounded. Are we anticipating a possible delay in launching the next crew rotation, which I think is supposed to happen next month.
Yeah, it's. I think it's more than possible. I think it's probable. We already see that the next crewed mission that was supposed to launch on Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon, which is actually a private mission called Polaris Dawn, that was supposed to launch at the end of July, and now that's delayed. And because that's delayed, that's going to tell me that every other crewed mission is also going to be delayed. So NASA's Crew 9 is going to be delayed. What they want to do is they want to make sure it's safe to launch Falcon 9, and they're going to test uncrewed launches, you know, payloads, satellites, before they put any people on board Dragon.
This was a private launch, though. This Starlink launch by SpaceX was a launch to a customer, a commercial customer. It just so happened to be that they were their own customer. Does NASA get access to that data, or does NASA keep a close eye on that, even if it was a commercial payload?
I'm sure that NASA will be informed by SpaceX if there's anything that they need to be informed about. But really, SpaceX at this point is coordinating with the FAA. So the FAA is responsible for the safety of launches and reentries. And SpaceX is providing a service to NASA. So NASA as a customer, and NASA being SpaceX is one of SpaceX's biggest and most important customers, is going to want to know what's going on. But it's not vital for NASA to know every step of the way. It's more important for, at this point, SpaceX to figure out what's wrong and fix it in coordination with the FAA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Laura Forsick, a space industry analyst and founder of the consulting firm Astrolytical, about the recent Falcon 9 malfunction and what this may mean for both SpaceX's Starlink program and the company's partnership with NASA to launch astronauts to the International Space Station. And it seems like a very good chance the next crew mission is delayed, a delay for a launch. There's also been a delay of the return for Boeing's crew that has been up there for quite a bit of time as NASA and Boeing work out investigating issues with their thrusters. We've had you on the show to talk about that. Are there kind of like these knockoff effects that happen with the delay of SpaceX system? Will Boeing stay up there longer? Can we even make assumptions about that? How does it impact human space flight at large?
You bring up important questions that we don't know the answers to yet. The International Space Station is getting very crowded. There's not a lot of room to maneuver the docking ports. And so what we're seeing now is, how do you juggle the logistics of a return of Boeing's Starliner in coordination with an arrival of the next crew mission of Dragon? And how do you coordinate that when we don't know how long the Falcon 9 is going to be grounded? And that's a big problem that NASA is currently working with SpaceX, with Boeing, and we just don't know the answers yet. But I can bet that this will affect the Starliner return simply because of that logistical juggling, the juggling act that NASA needs to do.
This leads to this idea that you mentioned the last time we had you on the show. And I saw on the social media platform X, there was some conversations about this with this particular term, dissimilar redundancy. Remind us again of what dissimilar redundancy is, and why is this a great example of why NASA wants it?
Exactly. So what happened here was that SpaceX has been so successful that we and NASA, but we as a whole community, the entire world in a sense, the Western world, has relied on SpaceX increasingly so. We have seen SpaceX Falcon 9 launches just every few days, and it seems like clockwork. It seems almost routine until something happens, and you just don't know what that something is going to be that's going to halt everything, like we're seeing here. Now, it shouldn't be a long, long pause. The last time this happened, it was a 6-month pause, and I don't see that happening this time around. It should be a pretty quick investigation. But while that investigation's going on, we just can't launch Falcon 9s, and we can't launch what was going to be on top of a Falcon 9. For example, there was the Northrop Grumman Cygnus, which was supposed to launch as a resupply mission on top of a Falcon 9, which is also going to be delayed most likely. So everything is a cascading effect because we relied on one system so much. And that's why it's important to have dissimilar redundancy, two systems that are different, so that if one goes down, the whole thing doesn't stop. And that is why NASA wants dissimilar redundancy with its crew capsules, so that when you have the grounding, whether it was a problem with Falcon 9 in this case or a problem with the Dragon, whatever reason, when you have one system down, you want another system to keep on operating so that things aren't at a standstill.
And in this particular case, would more than two operators be ideal? I mean, we're looking at an issue where Starliner can't return home until further investigation of the thruster issues. SpaceX can't launch Crew Dragon until it's been the upper stage has been cleared. Essentially, those two operators in this dissimilar redundancy cannot operate as intended. Would NASA want a third one in this particular instance? And is that in the cards?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the more the merrier. In fact, there were three in competition much earlier in the whole commercial crew program. There was the Dream Chaser, the Sierra Space Dream Chaser, which at this point is so far behind. It was not funded the way that Boeing and SpaceX were funded, but it is so far behind that we have not yet seen the Dream Chaser's first uncrewed launch, let alone a crewed launch, which will happen many years from now. So hopefully by the end of this year, we should see Dream Chaser come on board, launching on top of a Vulcan, ULA Vulcan, so that we can at least start seeing Dream Chaser come on board. But yes, I mean, right now, the only other third option is a Russian Soyuz. And NASA does not want to be in the same position it was after Space Shuttle retired, when it was relying only on Soyuz to get astronauts to and from the space station. It would be an embarrassment at this point, especially because of the geopolitics between the United States and Russia, and having to rely on Russian technology when you have two American systems not operating as they should. I mean, that is an embarrassment.
We've been focusing on the challenges of this upper stage issue with SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that this is the first issue with the Falcon 9 after hundreds of Falcon 9 launches. I mean, what does that say about SpaceX as a launch operator? And what do we know from its past issues in how they will tackle fixing this?
It really is remarkable that SpaceX has had so much success over the past 9 years that we got to high numbers of launches before we saw any kind of failure. And this wasn't even a complete failure, it was just a partial failure, which tells me that this system really is truly very reliable. But nothing is perfect and nothing is completely infallible. We need to be sure that we don't get complacent about our systems. And the way that SpaceX operates is they do tend to put things to their limit, you know, test their hardware to the limit. And so we could see that SpaceX has taken this as a lesson learned and will factor that into whatever constraints they had in terms of a leak in the engine and make it much more improved for the next time so that it's an even more robust system. And my guess is it's going to happen pretty quickly. But the key here is if they can identify the problem, fix it, and get approval from the FAA to launch again. And we don't know how long that's going to take. But it won't take 6 months like last time. Like I said, it should only take, my guess is, a few weeks, maybe a couple months.
Well, we've been speaking with Laura Forsyk. She's the founder and executive director of Astrolytical. Laura, thank you so much for joining us once again and providing us your insight.
Always a pleasure.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, you can reach out to us. We're at AWTY@cfpublic.org. And more space coverage is online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are we there yet? This is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Sophie Diaz. And editorial guidance is from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.